Hello, and thanks for joining us at Seen and Unseen Aloud. My name is Natalie Garrett. This is where you get to listen to a curated collection of the editor's top picks from our recent articles. We're here for you when you need to be eyes-free or hands-free, but still want to hear Christian perspectives on just about everything. The Beliefs That Made Jane Austen and Her World by Beatrice Scudler. There just wasn't a comprehensive book on Jane Austen's faith, Brenda Cox told me when I chatted to her recently. That's why I decided to write one, she said. There are a handful of books that treat Austen's Anglican faith seriously, even extensively. Irene Collins's two books on Austen, Jane Austen and the Clergy, and Jane Austen, the Parson's Daughter, as well as Laura Mooneyham White's Jane Austen's Anglicanism, are excellent examples. But they're also very academic. On the other hand, Cox's new book, Fashionable Goodness, Christianity in Jane Austen's England, achieves something truly remarkable. It's both highly accessible, assuming no prior knowledge of Austen's life, of theology, or of Regency history, and highly insightful. It's a true labour of love, Cox told me she spent years on reading and research, and it shows. Before I say anything else about Fashionable Goodness, let me urge you to read it. If you want to understand the way Austen and her characters saw the world around them, this is the book to pick up. I spent the last 10 odd years reading, thinking and writing about Austen, and yet Cox has made me see her novels in a new light. What she does best is to help us immerse ourselves into the daily life of Regency people, detailing in the first part of her book, how the Church of England functioned in Austen's times. She explains the difference between a vicar, a rector and a curate, what tithes were, what exams a young man had to pass to become an ordained priest. As I was reading Cox's book, Austen characters gradually came alive in my imagination like never before. Learning about how they lived their faith day to day help me to better grasp their motivations and their behaviour. For example, how many readers, myself included, have been left confused by the passage in Persuasion where Anne judges her cousin Mr. Elliot for his habits of Sunday travelling? It only starts to make sense once we know that travelling on a Sunday would have likely meant missing church attendance, of which Austen disapproved. Similarly, in Mansfield Park, Mary Crawford's scoffing remark that Edmund Bertram will become a celebrated preacher in some great society of Methodists will mean little to us unless we know that in the early 19th century, Methodists were often treated suspiciously and looked down upon as overly emotional and enthusiastic. To my surprise, even my opinion of Austen's most notoriously silly clergyman, Pride and Prejudice's Mr. Collins, improved. Cox points out Mr. Collins writes at least some of his own sermons at a time when many clergymen would simply pick a ready-written sermon out of a sermon book. He also is resident in his own parish of Hunsford after marrying Charlotte Lucas, when non-residents, the practice of a priest delegating all duties to a curate and living away from the parish, was common. Mr. Collins may be irritating and obsequious to a fault, but if we judge him by the standards of his own time, not of ours, he emerges as quite a respectable man after all. And that is something else that Cox does brilliantly. She shows us that the past is indeed a foreign country, with different moral standards. Instead of trying to find ways in which we're similar to the people of Austen's England, Cox helps us to realise that the values and assumptions of Austen's England are radically different from ours. Even our language is different. Focusing on what she identifies as key faith words, Cox shows us that we cannot understand just how deeply English society was steeped in the Christian faith unless we recognise the religious significance that many words had in Austen's times. For example, when Eleanor Dashwood cries to her sister Marianne, "Exert yourself," in Sense and Sensibility, She doesn't simply mean that Marianne should be less emotionally affected by Willoughby's betrayal. Rather, she's reminding Marianne of her religious duty of exertion, meaning not giving in to despair. When Anne Elliot engages an interval of meditation serious and grateful after her engagement to Captain Wentworth in Persuasion, we should not understand Anne's serious meditation as mere reflection. Austen would have expected her readers to know that, in this passage, Anne is examining her conscience and specifically praying. Even the word manners, often mentioned in Mansfield Park, has a deeper meaning than simply social graces, pointing to a person's religious principles. Cox encourages us to notice these differences and to let the past change our way of seeing the world through its alienness. Lastly, Cox also presents an England whose religious sensibilities were changing fast. The Church of England faced pressure to address its problems. Pluralism, the practice of one clergyman serving several parishes, meant that some members of the clergy were very well off, while others struggled to make a living. In turn, this encouraged non-residents, especially if the parishes were far from each other, and led to the non-resident parishes to be neglected. But at the same time, the Church of England was also being infused with newly found religious fervour. The evangelical and Methodist movements, still officially part of the Anglican Church at this point, were spreading at a rapid pace, thanks to figures like George Whitfield and the Wesley brothers, championing many worthy causes in the name of the Christian faith. The abolitionist movement, which was heralded by Wilberforce, Clarkson and Hannah More, was gaining momentum just as Austen was beginning to write novels. By the time Sense and Sensibility, her first, was published, the slave trade had been abolished in England. Sunday schools were opening up, which would educate thousands and thousands of children in the 19th century. The prison reform movement was gaining popularity, as were efforts to combat animal cruelty and ensure better conditions for factory workers. Goodness, as Cox put it, was becoming fashionable in England. What about Austen herself? Cox tells us that she mentions reading the works of abolitionists with pleasure in her letters, as well as remarking on the newly emerging evangelical movement with somewhat, like, cautious admiration. Far from being in ignorance of these changes in religious sensibility, Austen observed them, and they gave her hope. As Cox quotes in the final chapter of Fashionable Goodness, in an 1814 letter to her friend Martha Lloyd, Austen describes England as a nation, in spite of much evil, improving in religion. Austen was confident that faithful Christians could rise to the challenges placed before them, and this confidence is reflected in her heroines and her heroes, whose storylines trace their growth in virtue. It's perhaps not a coincidence that 1814 is also the year Austen started working on Mansfield Park, a novel whose heroine, Fanny Price, is famously the most ardent in her moral principles. Fanny's goodness, however, which the narrator often explicitly mentions, is no longer fashionable. Contemporary readers of Austen tend to dislike her seriousness and her outspoken religiosity. But perhaps if we join Brenda Cox in immersing ourselves in the alien country that is Regency England, we can learn to judge the goodness of Austen's characters by different standards from our own. Perhaps we can free ourselves from our prejudices and appreciate earnest characters like Fanny, as well as witty ones like Emma Woodhouse or Elizabeth Bennet. Perhaps we too, like Austen herself, will gain hope that goodness can be made fashionable once more in our time. Reenchanting Councils and Glum Councillors by Elizabeth Wainwright. At the local level in politics, I have found there is a stereotype that persists more than that of the corrupt politician. It is the glum councillor, the pothole poser, or sometimes the councillor looking glum while pointing at potholes. These are the photos that turn up on election leaflets and in local news. And there are lots of them here in Devon, because potholes are numerous and huge. When I was a district councillor, I tried to push back against this image. I would smile, avoid photos with potholes, share the good stuff found in the community alongside working to improve what wasn't working. But looking around the council chamber, it was hard to deny. Sometimes the glumness would slip into sleep. I've seen councillors prodded awake ahead of important votes that impacts tens of thousands of people. That is not just glum councillor. That is irresponsible, disengaged councillor. And though the responsibility lies with them, this never surprised me. In my four-year term, I too felt a disillusionment creep in. And I am perennially hopeful. My default is to see possibility. But 4 years in a context of budget cut after budget cut, endless bureaucracy, lifeless language, and an aversion to trying things differently, even I started to slump in my seat. I never fell asleep, but sometimes my soul did. Author farmer Wendell Berry, who speaks with much affection and wisdom about the importance and strength of local community, said that, unlike the local community, the government and the economy cannot be served with affection, but only with professional zeal or professional boredom. I have seen that professional boredom in the language, in the sterile council chamber bare of life, where processes and procedures rule more than humanity, where passionate members of the public would attend meetings only to be told they couldn't input because they hadn't pre-registered, where a meeting that finished before the allocated time was seen as successful regardless of the content. I'm sure it should feel more hopeful, more vision-led, more life-giving to be involved in local decision-making. It should be about place-making more than simply ticking boxes and balancing budgets. There are, of course, councillors who care deeply, and there are councils where local decision-making is being reclaimed to serve the local community, economy, identity, like the independent councillors elected into the town council in Buckfastleigh in South Devon, who made it more plain-speaking, more accessible and more engaged. And the flat-pack democracy movement started in Frome Town Council that has sparked similar local revolutions. But I think there's something else needed if local government is to replace lifelessness with hope and vision. Something more upstream of the how. In his essay, The Joys of Storytelling, Ben Ockrey says, in a fractured age when cynicism is God, here is a possible heresy. We live by stories. We also live in them. If we change the stories we live by, quite possibly we change our lives. I would often imagine a story of local government that makes space for enchantment. Former monk Thomas More speaks of re-enchanting as a reawakening to the depth of soul that embraces us and the world. Councils, like lots of spaces, feel disenchanted. Perhaps much of our current disenchantment is symptomatic of our alienation from ourselves, from each other, and from our shared humanity, and from the belief that this shared state of being is strong enough to take the weight of our world, even as heavy as it feels now. When the spirit of the age feels like cynicism more than delight, more than beauty, more than possibility, it impacts our relationships and the places that should thrive on good relationships like local government. Everything dulls. We disconnect from our spirit-breathed humanity. We forget that we were pulled from the soil by a gardener God who made us to be with each other, surrounded by beauty and life. In the book Faith, Hope and Carnage, the musician and writer Nick Cave says that the luminous and shocking beauty of the everyday is something I try to remain alert to, if only as an antidote to the chronic cynicism and disenchantment that seems to surround everything these days. It tells me that despite how debased or corrupt we are told humanity is and how degraded the world has become, it just keeps holding on being beautiful. It can't help it. Cave's words echo Dostoevsky, who wrote in The Idiot that the world will be saved by beauty, which in turn echoes earlier sentiments from the likes of Plato, Aristotle, and Thomas Aquinas, who taught that God is truth, goodness, and beauty. In the Bible, Jesus pointed again and again to these things too, in people, in creation, in God. They feel like good things to point the way now, more timeless and apolitical than any current vision in government, more tangible than a distant government, more life-giving than purely balancing budgets as a goal. Of course, local government also needs better and more reliable funding, more efficient processes, passionate people, and lots more. But I think these things are more likely to come in part from a re-enchanted local government that draws on the luminous and shocking beauty of the everyday and of local people and places. To start to make space for that re-enchantment, government could experiment with three things, which more than funding, needing people willing to try, to think beyond business as usual, to take existing resources and think about how they can be used even slightly differently. First, we could move away from language that is detached from emotion and care and life. The word enchant has its roots in words. Cantare means to sing. Councils could aspire to make language beautiful rather than bureaucratic, clear instead of obscure. It could invite local people into decision-making using life-giving and locally meaningful words and ideas rather than excluding them with jargon and lifeless language. For this, we'd need the help of local storytellers, poets, writers, speakers, people who can wake up with the power of words. Second, local government could bring that luminous beauty into the space, rather than sealing conversations and processes away in characterless buildings. Meetings I'd go to were usually in bland rooms with beige walls, nylon grey carpets, lukewarm coffee. Letting even some of the beauty of this world in, perhaps with colour, architecture, art, perhaps with stories and creativity and food, perhaps with some meetings outdoors in the beauty of the world, would, I think, breathe life into the space and into relationships, and so into what becomes possible. Lastly, re-enchanting local government must include rehumanizing it, because humanity at its best is relationship and soul and care. It contains the same possibility that was present in Eden when all this was dreamed up. If, as Christians believe, humanity is made in God's image, then God is endlessly creative. God is about the detail of our lives as well as the world-shaking stories. God is about life, life that is so alive it overcomes death. It may not need to overcome death, but local government could embrace local people, their humanity, their aliveness. It could ask them to show up as themselves, with all their strengths and weaknesses, their ideas and hopes and fears, rather than shut them out because they cannot bend to inflexible meetings and procedures and language. It would not shy away from these things. It would use them to create new life and thriving spaces. Re-enchanting local government could, I think, bring us closer to beauty, to the goodness of each other, to the truth of people and places. From there, I think it becomes possible to restore relationships, to imagine what government might be at its best, and to view it as a place-based way of knowing and actually serving people. I think it becomes easier from there to look downstream, to rethink processes, the voting system, the rules of business as usual, and perhaps even to fix potholes and the glumness that goes with them. Teresa Lola's Poetical Hope by Jonathan Evans. There are poems such as T.S. Eliot's Journey of the Magi and U.A. Fanthorpe's B.C. A.D., which have become staples of Christmas carol services. Last Christmas, for the first time, I used Teresa Lola's Look at the Revival as the poem in our carol service that explored the experience of the Magi in seeking and finding Jesus. Look at the Revival was commissioned by the National Gallery in 2020 in response to the Adoration of the Kings painting by Jan Gossard. The poem is written in the voice of Balthazar, the Black King in the painting, and explores the painting's themes of rupture, transformation, and renewal. It ends with this reflection. My job often feels like a hefty stone, but today I am powered by a fierce awe. I say to the stunned people, let us look deeply to know this hope deeply. British Nigerian poet and former Young People's Laureate for London, Lola is the British equivalent of Amanda Gorman, whose poem The Hill We Climb made such an impact at US President Joe Biden's inauguration. Lola said after that event that to have poetry make national headlines was just so exciting. And to have Gorman's poem articulate everyone's feelings was just the perfect example of what poetry can do. There is a real art to writing poetry for public occasions where depth and immediacy need to intertwine. It is an art that Lola herself has mastered, as was demonstrated when she was commissioned by the Mayor of London's office to write and read a poem for those who listen when courage calls at the unveiling of Millicent Fawcett's statue in Parliament Square. Lola was joint winner in 2018 of the Brunel International African Poetry Prize and was featured in the 2019 Forces for Change issue of British Vogue as a next generation talent. Other commissions for her work, which explores themes of self-discovery, transformation, cultural heritage and belonging, have included Selfridges, Rimowa, Royal Festival Hall and Audible. She is currently leading the Volunteer Interpreter Programme at Dulwich Picture Gallery, where, in a programme inspired by their Soulscapes exhibition, she is exploring how poetry can be used to interpret their collection. Her debut poetry collection, In Search of Equilibrium, which was hailed as powerful and rigorous, is an extraordinary and exacting study of death and grieving. The reviews of this collection have much to say about the wellsprings of her work. In this collection, as S. Nirashini writes, she deftly deploys form, texture and shape to interrogate the meaning of death and the suffering of family, with poems variously presented as computer coding, life reportage, prayers, algorithms, Wikipedia entries and hip-hop lyrics. While its subject matter is, as Carmina Masoliver writes, essentially natural life and death, the poems themselves are often experimental and bring in cultural elements as well as religious allusions. Charlie Hill explains that this superb debut collection revolves around the death of the poet's grandfather, whose Alzheimer's resulted in a 4-year funeral. Laurie Smith suggests it is rare for a debut collection by a young poet to be so death-haunted. But it is death-haunted in the same sense as Sylvia Plath's Ariel and Anne Sexton's To Bedlam and Partway Back. He writes that the comparison isn't fanciful, as Lola's writing has a similar vividness and strength. Masoliver notes that the collection is bookended with Lola's own prayer and psalm. From the first, she suggests, there is an expression of doubt about the poet's faith, though holding on to it, even when I fear God might be a thin shadow. Yet, by the time we get to the final poem, there is a loss of innocence to the reality of the world that is around us, but a certain strength that comes with fighting darkness. Nirashini states that this poet speaks boldly of prayer as a call to arms for family, for love, for a survival, which, as she concludes in the final poem, Psalm 151, I pray my fists into. Lola has said that the writing of the collection was emotionally challenging, as the poems touch on sensitive topics about death, faith, family, and mental health. For her, writing poetry has been a therapeutic tool, a healthy listening ear, and a way to express her struggles, be they anxiety or grief. Nevertheless, she also says, "My poems always suggest and show hope, no matter how gritty the subject is. I do write poems that are centred around my faith, and that hope in my faith is Jesus." Many reviewers note Lola's ability to write lines such as, "Sweeping me off my bones, that stop you dead." Hannah Williams was particularly moved by lines from "Blessed are the mothers of a dead child." "Blessed are the mothers of a dead child, for they manage to recover after eating the fruit that grows from planting your child's casket in the ground." Hill cites the final lines of the same poem. "My grandmother tries to celebrate the brief beauty of his breath. She says, what use is sweeping grief under the carpet when you can blend it to find the drop of sanity that will flow from it? To suggest that it is here that the equilibrium sought in the collection's title is to be found." The Sunday Times Style magazine has described Lola as being among the ranks of an exciting new wave of young female bards who are widening the appeal of poetry for a new generation. As a result, the imminent prospect of a second collection from her is a particularly exciting prospect. Look out later in the year, then, for Ceremony for the Nameless, which is described as exploring the act of naming and its role in shaping our identities, our aspirations, what we carry and how we belong. In lyrical, joyful and moving poems, Lola will explore the ways our journey through life might require us to cast off old expectations, both others and our own, just as at other times it can bring us back, strangely and unexpectedly, to where we first began. This returns us to Balthazar and his journey of discovery. So, as he states, let us look deeply to know this hope deeply. Thank you for listening. If you like our podcast, help others to discover it. Leave a review and rate us wherever you get seen and unseen love. Help others discover a world that is greater, more full of meaning and sense than they might ever have imagined.